folks, welcome back to another episode of Mayhem in the Mid-South. Today we're going to look at the Stopwatch Gang. If you've ever watched the movies, The Town, Point Break, or Heat, and you liked them, then you'll probably enjoy this story today, because all three of those movies, action movies, all used elements of the Stopwatch Gang. Now the gang, who is also known as the Presidential Robbers, over a period of about 20 years, took about $15 million thereabouts from banks and department stores, airports, all across Canada and the U.S. And as their moniker implies, they did actually use a stopwatch during their robberies to ensure that they didn't stay in the banks too long. Now, the one thing you can say about these robbers is of these 140 or so robberies they committed, they never physically harmed a single person. No civilians, no bank employees, no security guards, no police. And I say physically harmed. Now there's aspects to robberies, it's the mental side, and there's many a robbery victims and they never quite recover from the fear of surviving a bank robbery or just a robbery in general. So if you had to give any kudos at all to these bad men, it would be that at least they didn't use violence, only the threat of, if you can consider that a positive. Now, the reason this episode's been featured on Mayhem is because when it's all said and done, the very last of the members is going to meet his downfall in the little city of South Haven, Mississippi. A man featured on America's Most Wanted and other crime-solving shows, who was virtually, maybe not uncatchable, but certainly uncontrollable, met his match in that little police department, who in the long run proved they were more than a match for the Stopwatch Gang. Now, obviously, I'm not going to even attempt to cover the number of robberies they committed, so we're going to highlight just a few of them. They're bigger ones, and they had a bunch of big robberies. Now, the presidential mask that they would wear, that was not all the time, but that was one of their many disguises that they used when they hit banks or hit department stores. The stopwatch was a given, the presidential mask here and there. And just to briefly go over the typical MO for the gang, they would scout the place they were going to hit. And if it was a bank, which most of their robberies occurred in banks, one or two of the robbers would go to the bank and open up accounts. And they would frequently go in the bank and make deposits or withdrawals. They would chat with the tellers. And obviously the having the accounts there justified them actually being in the bank so they could scout the bank. And they wanted to pick up on where the guards stood, where the guards were at different times of the day, when the manager was at his desk, when the manager wasn't at his desk, when the vault doors were open. And they would even rent a safety deposit box so they had an opportunity to actually be in the vault or close to it. They would even go in with, say, 10s and 20s and ask the teller to exchange that for $100 bills because they wanted to see where the larger bills were kept. Did they have these larger bills at the actual teller's window, or did they have to go to another room to get them? And that told them where the big bills were at. Now, after they'd done this for a month or so, 2 months, the robbers would actually physically leave town and go somewhere else and hang out. And they wouldn't get anywhere around that bank for at least a month. And the reason they did this is because they had learned that the FBI and other police organizations, first thing they would do is pull the tape of the robbery the day of and then the days previous to the robbery to see if they could spot the robbers inside the bank casing the place. Now they'd come back into town a few days before they were going to hit the business. They'd get them a stolen car, and then they would swap out the plates on the stolen car with a set of plates from a car of a similar model that didn't show to be stolen. They would get them a place to hang out, an apartment or whatever, their little hideout. They'd get fake identification, they'd get guns, disguises, and they mapped out the area around the bank or business they were going to hit. Now, once they committed the robbery, it was two men inside and one in the getaway car. And when they left, they drove a predetermined route. They always liked to pick places close to a freeway so they could get onto the freeway in a hurry and then get back off. They would then drop that stolen car and then they would get into the second car. Now, once they made the switch to different cars, typically one of the robbers, who generally wore a jogging outfit under his robbery clothes, would just take off jogging away from the drop-off point of the cars. One of them would take the second car, the money, and all the articles used in the robbery and drive back to the wherever their hideout was. And then the third robber, he generally walked to the nearest bus stop and caught a bus. Now, their first robbery that I'm going to mention was, at the time, the largest gold heist in the history of Canada. It's 1974, Ottawa Airport. The gang had found out through inside information that gold bars were regularly being shipped through Ottawa Airport. Now, this gold was on its way from Red Lake gold mines, that's in northwestern Ontario, to the Royal Canadian Mint. Now, this gold was kept in a cage in the Air Canada freight terminal. Now, all it had on it was a small padlock and one guard. So, on the night of the robbery, April 17, 1974, the phone rings inside the warehouse where the gold's at. It's about 11:14 p.m. Now, the guard on duty, he answers the phone, and the voice on the other end sounds all perturbed and upset, and his first question is, has my man arrived yet? Now, of course, this throws the guard off. Now, the voice on the phone then tells him that there's an Air Canada employee that's been sent over there to pick up some de-icing fluid from the freight shed. And the caller goes on to mention that, you know, we got to get that de-icing fluid or we're going to be delayed on our flights. So now while they're still on the phone, the security guard, he hears a knock at the warehouse door. He goes to the door, and sure enough, there's a fellow there in a Air Canada uniform. Guard tells the fella in the uniform that, hey, your boss is looking for you. So when the fella steps inside, he pulls a gun, tells the guard it's a robbery. He removes the gold bars and locks the security guard up in the cage. Now those six gold bars, valued at $750,000. Now today that would be valued at about $4 million. Now at some point after this robbery, all three of the suspects are going to get arrested. And they're all going to go to prison in, there in Canada. But as it turns out, prison's not really a deterrent to the three suspects, because they all escape eventually within a few years of being incarcerated. Now the three robbers, they end up down in Tampa, Florida. And of course they're going to work again. And they decide they're going to hit Robinson's department store. Now this is in the late 70s. And of course they're going to do their scouting. And they had noticed that the employees on the second floor at the cashier's office, that each week when the Brinks guard was going to show up to collect the money, they would pull the bags of money out of the vault and put them in a little side office there by the cashier's windows. And they had seen the guard come down the hall, go into the office, and then one of the cashiers would drag the money over, and the guard would give her some type of a yellow verification slip, and then he would get the money and leave. So now the crafty suspects, they got them a uniform as close as they could to what a Brinks uniform looked like, and two of them went upstairs, one of them in the Brinks uniform and the other suspect was posing as a customer. Now, the only thing that he didn't have was that yellow piece of paper, that slip. Now, that's when he was going to have to go to robbery mode then. So the two went in there at separate times, and as soon as the clerk pulls the money over there waiting on that yellow verification slip, he pulls a gun and says it's a robbery. So they get the money. They go to the elevators. No one's been hurt. So they get down on the ground floor, carry the money through the women's department, out the back door into the car, and they drive off. Now that robbery netted them several thousand dollars. They made a successful getaway, and they decided it was time to move on. Now their next stop, they go out to the West Coast, and they're in the San Diego area. So it's September 23rd, 1980. And the gang has been casing the Bank of America branch that's located at 912 Garnett Avenue. And they're going to hit it when the armored truck is going to arrive at the bank to make a pickup. Because they had noticed that when the armored car is getting ready to get there, the bags of money are no longer behind the locked vault. So it's their typical setup. They got the driver outside in the car. Two of them are inside in disguises. Now, they actually sat in the bank for quite a long period of time, because on this particular day, the Loomis truck is late getting there. In fact, 28 minutes behind. And the two of them are at different parts of the bank waiting. Well, they see the guard come in. He goes over and he picks up, gets the money, and he's wheeling it out. Now, it's interesting that before they actually started the robbery, the one suspect who gives the hand signals and runs the inside of the bank. He's watching the guard pick up bags and carrying them out. Well, he notices the way the bags are sagging, that those first bags are nothing but change, quarters or whatnot. Well, he doesn't want to hit a bag and have nothing but change in it. So they wait until the guard picks up some bags and it looks like it's cash inside of it and not coin. And in fact, it's not until the third trip that the guard picks up what looks like cash bags and not change that he loads onto the cart. Now, when the guard gets halfway to the door from the vault, that's when they move. They stick a pistol on him. They tell him it's a robbery and don't be a hero or we're going to kill you. The guard would later tell the FBI that the guys seemed very calm and professional. He said they were almost polite. So they disarm the guard, get everybody to lay on the floor. They each pick up one of the bags of cash and they walk out of the bank. Now at that time, that was the largest bank robbery in the history of San Diego. Broad daylight, and they walked out with $283,000. Now that's pretty good. You're talking about 1980. That's when a dollar was worth just a little bit more than it is today. So that's a good haul there. Now, they had a little oopsie in their operation. The discarded money bags from that San Diego bank robbery, they were found in a dumpster by an elderly couple that was rummaging through the dumpster looking for an aluminum can. Now, from those money bags, they got a partial fingerprint, and that fingerprint was from one of the robbers. And then through the evidence recovered there and from an informant that the FBI had, they were able to track the suspects to Arizona. Now, all three of the suspects are in the Sedona, Arizona area. Two of them are staying in the same cabin, which is right near the Slide Rock State Park. And that's in the Oak Creek Canyon there. Now, the third robber, he's down the street. He's not in the same cabin complex that they are. He's got a place a little further away. So the police hit the cabin, lock up the two suspects, but they don't get the third one because he's out of town and he stays out of town. Now it's interesting, this lone suspect, he continued to commit robberies, Florida, Arkansas, and he heads back towards Arizona and he gets caught. But now he don't stay caught long because he escapes from the prison there in Arizona. And he does it in broad daylight, going through the air vents, getting out in the utility room and just basically walking right out of the prison. He actually flees the country and goes to the Philippines. Now, he lives in the Philippines. He gets married, has a child, and he's there until about 1994, thereabouts, late 1993. And on America's Most Wanted, they had featured him again. Now, some of his neighbors in the Philippines recognized him. FBI gets notified. Time the local police and the feds get there, our boy's already gone back into the U.S. Now, this lone suspect, the last remaining member of the Stopwatch Gang, he rolls into South Haven, Mississippi there, right there at the state line to Tennessee and the city of Memphis. And he's going to hit the Deposit Guaranty National Bank there. That's on Getwell. Now, at the time he's going to do this robbery, there's 9 banks in South Haven. Now, later on, he would say that this bank was going to be easy. He said it's going to be so easy his sister could have robbed it. Now, he's going to use a trick that they had used before, and that is you make a bogus call to the police and have them going somewhere else in town to draw them away from the bank you want to hit. Now, he kind of overdid it, I think. He gets on a payphone first and he calls a local hospital. And I'm pretty sure that's probably the Methodist hospital there in South Haven. Well, anyways, he calls there and he tells them there are some people that were kidnapped. They're in the trunk of a green car in your parking lot. Now, that hospital's on the other end of the city, obviously. And he figures the hospital's going to call and get the police to make that scene. Now, he adds that the people in the trunk, they may be dead already. Then he makes a second call, and that's the city hall. And he talks in a different voice. And he said there's a bomb in the building, and it's getting ready to blow up. Then he makes a third call, and he calls another bank, a bank on the other end of town. And he says, you're about to get robbed. Two guys are going to come in 2 minutes. They're going to kill everybody in the bank. Well, now, unfortunately for our third suspect, South Haven PD is not a bunch of country bumpkins. They're a really good police department, especially so during this time period. Their chief, Tom Long, was the real deal. He was a real police, and he had real police working for him. Now, South Haven had been hit before by somebody who would put in bogus phone calls to draw the police away. Now, it didn't work when that fella had tried it, and it wasn't going to work this time. Because what they did was, is they sent police to each of the banks because the chief was smelling a rat. So they send officers to each one of the banks to watch the banks. Now, the chief, he actually decides he's going to go to that Deposit Guarantee National Bank there. That's the spot he's going to watch. Him and there's another car there. So you got two police watching that bank from a distance. So now it's a Tuesday and it's raining. And our boy, he goes into the bank wearing a blonde wig and dark sunglasses. And he's got green and pink ribbons attached to the shirt, because him and the rest of the gang had learned that if you put distracting looking items on your shirt or jacket, that witnesses will remember that and won't remember what the suspect looked like. So now he hits it right after the lunchtime crowd has left the bank, and he goes in with a pistol and a fake bomb and a green shaving kit. Now, what he had done that morning, he'd been following a Loomis armored truck around South Haven from business to business. And he knew the bank was probably going to have some money as well. So now he goes into the bank, takes his green turtleneck and pulls it over the bottom part of his face. And he gets the money they've got in the vault. It's about $100,000. So he goes into the vault, stuffs his blue duffel bag with money, and he heads out. And he walks out of the bank. Before he leaves out the doors, he takes that green shaving kit and he puts it in the middle of the lobby and he tells everybody this is a bomb. Says no one better move or the bomb will go off if you try to run to the doors. So he walks out, and he was in there less than 90 seconds. He even had his stopwatch with him. Now, he was in an old Ford LTD, and he starts backing out. And when he does, he gets rammed. Chief Long rams him, and that other officer, his car, rams him. They hit him from two sides, the back and the side. And, of course, the collision causes him to go bouncing across the seat. And when he raises back up, he's got the police with pistols at the windows. And he's caught, and he goes to prison. So the stopwatch gang in prison and basically stayed in prison. But I'm proud to say that the last of the three met his demise at the hands of the little police department there in Mississippi.